This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Rabia here, and I'm joined with my brilliant co-host, Susan Simpson. Hey, Susan.
Rabia, you sound very cheerful today.
Do I sound cheerful?
No, you know, not at all.
I am literally, I think I'm consuming, like, I can't stop. I've been stress eating all day, and it is about 10 p.m., and right before we jumped on, I made myself a huge sandwich. There's absolutely no reason for it other than it's Super Tuesday, and I'm a little bit super pissed. Things are not working out the way I wanted them to. But yeah, so I know you've been working on some other stuff, but I'm sure you're following along.
I actually have not been. This is my first update all evening. So what's going on?
Really? Okay. Well,
yeah.
You know, the last couple of days you had Pete drop out and Amy Klobuchar drop out and move their votes.
Vaguely aware of all that.
Yep. They endorsed Biden. I don't know if that's what's done it, but Biden is coming out really strong. I mean, he won South Carolina, but he seems to be leading in California, I believe. Virginia he won. I think Massachusetts, they're calling for Bernie, but Biden has really turned some stuff around. Warren is nowhere to be seen yet. So, you know, but the night's young, I guess, in a way, and California takes forever to count. So let's see. But it just feels like there's a lot of, like, she's just kind of been erased. Like, it just seems like it's a two-way. And Bloomberg won American Samoa. So good for him. $500 million well spent. and that's about it. I mean, so that's where we are. Okay, let me ask you this. We've talked before about, like, Trump's, you know, cognitive issues. Sometimes it seems like I've been feeling more of that with Biden too lately. Have you felt that at all in any of his, like, the last few weeks?
I feel like it is a travesty that our leading candidates on both sides are all men in their 70s. Trump is now the youngest man in the entire damn race.
Right.
Which is, I mean, that by itself is alarming.
Oh, you mean the oldest? Yeah, he's not the oldest. Well, here's the thing. I mean,
he's the youngest.
He's the youngest. Okay, Warren is younger, but yeah, you're right. I mean, like, in terms of who the front runners are between Biden and Bernie. I mean, what? My question for the voters who are voting for either one of them is: do you see any realist? And you want to vote for a president you think is going to be able to do two terms, going to be able to get reelected in 4 years, is not going to be a lame duck one term president first time around. I do not see
Biden running two terms. That doesn't seem realistic.
Or Bernie. But I also have seen online suggestions.
Just saying, it's a more consequential VP pick than it usually is.
Right. It is. So, and maybe that VP pick might, like, change my mind on some of this. But, you know, let's see how it goes. There's all kinds of names in the air. And I wish it would be great if they just announced now. I think that could make a real big difference in how people vote. But anyway, look.
Well, if Biden's doing well, I'm excited to have the return of the Brisbane investigation.
That's exactly what's going to happen tomorrow morning, very early. And the other thing is this. Okay, look, it's Super Tuesday, but, you know, I live in Maryland. You know when our primary is, Susan?
What, same as D.C.'s? Like June?
April 28th. Wait,
ours is June, to be totally honest. Yeah.
No. I mean, none of this makes sense to me, but anyway.
The entire system is screwed up, and every 4 years we realize this, and yet every 4 years we do it again.
We do it again. All right.
Now, my concern was that yesterday there was an extremely unusual, I don't want to say unprecedented, but I can't recall anything like it, where there was a statement by both the Intel and our law enforcement agencies and State Department, joint statement from all the agencies, putting out a kind of, like, not dire alarm, but a very stern, like, all voters, be aware, be an alert. Foreign actors are trying to interfere in our election. They'll do their best to undermine your, like, trust in our election system. Which, to me, seems to indicate there was some kind of specific threat or concern that motivated this. This wouldn't come out of nowhere, I wouldn't think.
I totally missed it. I have not seen that anywhere on social media.
Yeah, well, at the same time, Trump was like, they're rigging the election against Bernie Sanders. So maybe that got lost in the noise. But I was... I mean, that was enough for me to kind of wonder, like, is there an actual specific threat they're preempting here or expecting to happen?
What kind of threat are we talking about if you're warning voters? Like, if there's like a direct attack on, let's say, like voting machines, some kind of electronic, you know, hanky panky, the voters can't do nothing about that. So what I'm saying is, what are you asking voters to look out for is what I'm trying to figure out.
They're not asking voters to look out for anything so much as they're asking voters to have faith in the system. They're trying to say, look, someone's going to try and do something that we're not going to specify what that's going to make you doubt our system, but don't doubt it. Oh, yeah. It's an ineffective way of responding to the threat. Like either, I mean, it's a tough place to be in because you don't want to make things worse by talking about it, but also.
Well, here's the thing. I'd be like, well, I'm just going to go and vote and totally trust the system. And now you're telling me something's going to happen. So I should, like, maybe if you didn't tell me, I might not be worried. I don't know. That's weird.
Well, the thing is, the threat they're warning against is Trump. Like, Trump's statements are exactly the threat they're warning against. Trump is undermining trust in the elections by trying to claim Bernie Sanders being, you know, having the election rigged against him, or that somehow things are being done to cause him to lose. Yeah. So, like, the threat they're concerned about is exactly the stuff Trump is tweeting.
Wait, I'll say this.
Maybe he's the before and after they're warning about it. Who knows?
Right. On one hand, you could have that. On the other hand, what if this is like a long game, this big old setup where they start like planting these seeds, and if Trump loses, they can say, nope, null and void. It was like electoral interference. It was foreign actors. It was a war on our elections. Because I feel like, you know, we know he's not going to concede if he loses. So the way he would do
He's protesting that Bernie Sanders being like has things rigged against him. Of course he's going to claim he's having it rigged against him.
Yeah. So the sad thing is I trust nothing now, not even like a statement like that. So I don't know.
You are giving in to the foreign interference, Rabia.
I guess I am. But look at what's happening. Okay, can we talk a little bit about, I mean, just look at the response to coronavirus. And I'm talking about the administration's response, the different agencies' response. Why should we have faith in any of these agencies at this point? I mean, everything has become politicized.
Well, I don't think the objection is that things are being politicized, because this is a political issue. I mean, this is something that the government is designed to respond to, and only the government can respond to effectively. So by definition, it is a political issue.
No, just because a government responds to something, this is a public health issue. I don't see this as a political issue at all. I don't think it should matter.
But the response is a political issue. Like, it has to be, it is the government's responsibility to do this. How they handle it is inherently political. Now, trying to score,
I guess that's one way to look at it. But then the whole hoax thing, which we can talk about, the way Trump is. Okay, but okay, let's get into this. Let's get into coronavirus. That's where we're at.
Hooray.
Hooray. Oh, okay. All right, let's start here.
Update. So, past few days, we are currently in the early escalation phase. Yeah. We now have 9 confirmed deaths from coronavirus. We have
all in Seattle.
If you listen to Pence's briefing, which you couldn't listen to because it wasn't recorded in any way, you would think that there were 77 people infected with confirmed coronavirus infections in the U.S. But we know for a fact it's at least 115 confirmed infections. But also we know for a fact.
How do we know that?
The trackers have 115 plus cases confirmed.
Okay.
Pence's data was out of date. But yeah. The thing is, we know for a fact there are many, many, many more infected in the United States because we already have 9 deaths. And even at the worst possible estimates of its fatality rate, it ain't like over
20%, 15%. Yeah. Right. Well, right now, the World Health Organization, I think today, raised that rate to 3.4%. It was at 2% last week when we talked. 3.4% now fatality rate, which is pretty alarming.
We're not going to know the fatality rate yet. It's too soon. The numbers change so much statistically. We can't figure that out. The point is, though, it doesn't matter. We know it's high enough to be terrifying. But we also know it's manageable. I mean, we know, like, look at like Singapore and South Korea. They have the fatality rate is definitely under 1%, right. Much, much less than that. Actually, I think Singapore is like maybe even 0% at this point, or like 1 or 2 deaths with like 100 cases or something. Either way, point being, we know coronavirus doesn't have to be a catastrophe. We know that governments that are responding effectively can do so. On the other hand, we also know that if it goes unchecked, you can get some pretty horrifying situations pretty fast, like we're seeing in Iran right now.
Right. And one of the ways it's getting unchecked here is the fact that we are at a complete loss for, like, we have no testing ability, it seems like. In South Korea, they're testing, like, 10,000 people a day are getting tested to see if they have coronavirus. in the United States, like, I spent like an hour trying to figure this out. I can't even figure out how people can get tested. In fact, this one woman tweeted a really interesting whole tweet about her personal experience. And I think it really illustrates kind of like the issue in a way that, like, even, you know, news stories don't. So this is a woman who lives in Seattle. She said she has all the symptoms of coronavirus and a history of chronic bronchitis. So she already has a compromised immune system. She already has underlying issues, you know. She says she works in a physical therapy clinic with patients who are over 65 years old. And a lot of them have chronic illnesses. So imagine if she has coronavirus and she's working with these patients, right? She said she wanted to be responsible and go get tested. This is how it went, she says. Now, her Twitter handle, by the way, is @into_the_brush if you want to look it up yourself. She says she called the Corona hotline, which is like a CDC, I guess it's a CDC hotline, was on hold for 40 minutes, gave up. And then she looked at the website at Washington State Public Health websites. They said, go see a primary care doctor, but no information on how to get tested. She called some doctors. They said they have no idea where she could get tested, that she should try to go to the ER maybe. She called the ER. ER said, no idea, call a hospital. She called the hospital. They said, we don't have any tests. Then transferred her back to the coronavirus hotline. And then she finally got through. Now, the lady on the hotline said, here's the thing. We're not testing people like you. We're testing people who fall within a specific category. They've been out of the country in the last 14 days, or they've had contact with one of the few people who have recently been tested and come up positive, and that's it. So basically, until she gets, what she thinks is, until she gets so sick that she has to be hospitalized, and then maybe they'll test her. And by then, I mean, either she self-quarantines, or she spread it to who knows how many people. Susan, do you think it's fair to say that women know women's bodies best?
Yes, absolutely.
That's right. And that's why, like, when it comes to all kinds of issues related to women, I'm like, you know, whether it's products that women use or other things, you know, I try to look for products that have the hand of a woman involved in the design and the implementation and all that. And that's one of the many reasons that, at least for the last, what, almost 2 years now, I have been using Ritual Vitamins.
And my main concern in any kind of product is how easy and convenient it is. Luckily, in this case, that all comes together because Ritual Vitamins are both extremely easy and convenient to get every month with the recurring order. And also, they're produced by a team by Kat Schneider and her team of scientists who make clinically tested a new normal.
They have obsessively researched every nutrient because they're all about creating this visionary women's multivitamin. Anybody who knows, like, the whole routine of getting all the vitamins you need in your body, it's like dozens of bottles and nobody can manage that. But they've simplified it to the point where you just take two pills a day, and it'll give you everything you need.
Without thinking about it, which for me, again, is key.
Yep. And for those of you who are, like, obsessive, you know, about reading labels, Ritual uses vegan-certified, non-GMO, gluten-free, allergen-free ingredients. All the sources are out there for the whole world to see. Total transparency. And they're really, really gentle on an empty stomach. So,
look, I know I don't eat right. I'm, you know, lazy slash busy, whatever my excuses of the day. And I'm, you know, fairly confident I'm probably not getting all the ideal nutrients I should be. So that's why I like Ritual. It's good to know that, to some extent, you know, my other failings aside, at least the basic stuff I need to survive, I'll have that.
See, Susan, you're young enough to, like, not eat well, take some Ritual and be fine. I'm old enough that I eat well, but I still need the help. So anyway, look, daily changes can lead to big results, and that's why you got to start small today. Ritual is offering our listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Try it out, satisfaction guaranteed. Just go to ritual.com/45th and start your Ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/45th.
This is the first scandal. I'm sure there'll be many, and scandal's not the right word for it because it implies, like, a political, like, minor phrasing problem as opposed to, like, a life and death screw up. But the first and biggest problem was that even though coronavirus has been known to be a potential pandemic for, what, a month and a half now? Probably longer.
Oh, longer, yeah.
And even though China took, draconian is understating it, draconian right. efforts to halt spread and gave more nations more time, the United States didn't use that time. As of last week, there were less than 500 tests done by the CDC.
Insane.
And we don't know how many they've done now because they took that reporting off their website.
Yep. So no more statistics, no more numbers listing where you could get tested. It's gone.
Keep in mind, before I was watching the site before they took the stuff down, the last like 3 days, 3-4 days that the reporting was up there, we were testing between like 4 and 13 people per a day. South Korea has done like over 70,000 tests. Yeah. China can do 1.5 million tests in a week. So like the technology is there and exists. Why can't we do it? Well, and take the case of the woman who was, I think, the first identified case in the United States of community spread. She had been in the hospital for 10 days before she was finally tested, before the CDC finally caved and agreed to test her. And surprise, surprise, it was coronavirus. Now, the big question that we don't have an answer to yet is why. And there's a lot of possible factors here, and it's probably a little bit of everything situation. But it's hard not to wonder how much Trump's focus on messaging is playing into this.
Oh, yeah.
Because, so this is like not a new problem. Our inability to test, and again, 500 is nothing. Like that's meaningless nothing at this point.
Yeah.
But we've known for a while that there's an issue here because in January, like late January, there were already calls with the CDC who were, aware of the emerging threat. And they were, at that point, although there are 5 cases in the United States, not from community spread, but from people importing it from abroad, there was no one who could test it except the CDC in Atlanta. They're the only place where you could get a test, like, is it coronavirus? Yes, no. And when they're asked why they didn't have more labs that could do it, the CDC's response was, quote, "We hold ourselves to an incredibly high standard of precision in terms of laboratory testing.
Hmm.
And we wouldn't want to inadvertently make a mistake in terms of patient care." Now, okay, that sounds good in the abstract, but there's an emerging pandemic, so maybe you would want to, like, expand that somewhere?
Also, their first round of coronavirus tests actually had a flaw in them, and they couldn't able to use them. So, whatever their standard is, I mean, their own test had a component that was flawed in it. So, it was completely useless.
So, the CDC's test was flawed. It had an error that involved, well, it was flawed in a way that meant you could still theoretically use it to test for coronavirus, but some of those, like, testing controls, like, weren't working right. But the thing was, when the United States declared that the outbreak was, like, a whole public health emergency, what that actually does under our, bureaucratic processes is that it makes the FDA have approval authority, quote, emergency use approval over any test. So by doing that, by calling it an emergency, we suddenly cut off the ability of other states, other labs to develop their own test.
Mm-hmm. But that only happened this past weekend, which is really late in the game. And here's
No, the declaration was in end of January, and that meant other labs could not test. Like, by doing that, they blocked people from testing. Yeah.
Okay.
Because of how it was written, the way it works, that when they declared an emergency, it meant the FDA had to approve anyone outside of the government from doing this test.
So this past Saturday is when they lifted it. They lifted that prohibition.
Finally. Yeah. But here's the part where I'm willing to believe a lot of bureaucratic incompetence, even at the CDC, which is a little bit, it's one of the agencies we expect competence to be assumed and not a rarity. But we know that right when all this is going on with their CDC's tests failing, no one else being able to test, a lot of states having a lot of frustrations, a lot of patients being referred and could not get a test because until a week ago, the conditions were that you can't get tested unless, like, one, you've been to China, or two, someone who's been confirmed to have COVID-19.
Was in contact with you.
Yeah. So on the 22nd of February, again, pretty recent, the FDA director of, like, their diagnostics division was going to the CDC to try and figure out a way to solve this, a way to make this thing get fixed. The CDC wouldn't let him in.
What?
Yeah. He'd been there to expedite, development of new lab tests for COVID-19 and to expand testing. And he shows up at the CDC and they're like, oh, we don't have... They knew he was coming. Wasn't a surprise. But for whatever reason, they're like, oh, we can't let you in yet. So he had to wait around overnight until they finally let him in. It was only that, a couple days later, the 24th, that they finally... FDA asked for enforcement discretion that would, sidestep this whole emergency snafu they caused and would allow certain private and state labs to use their own test. And on February 26th is when it finally went through. Now, as we now know today, February 26th is actually the day that people were already dying of COVID-19 infections, but they'd never been diagnosed, and no one knew about it till a week later.
Okay, here's what I'm really confused, and I haven't found the information on this. What I don't understand is the World Health Organization has these tests available. China, other countries have these tests available. Why aren't we just using, why aren't we buying those tests, using those tests?
Because we're supporting American manufacturing.
Really?
We're not using, I don't even know. But like, right, the CDC wouldn't use foreign stuff because of whatever reason. So like, here's the thing is, again, we can't answer at this point, and maybe it's not even, maybe it doesn't even matter, but I mean, we're screwed either way. But like, why did the CDC screw this up? Was it because they just were fuck-ups? Or because there was pressure, either explicit or implicit, to downplay the threat and to not start community testing measures earlier? We don't know. We don't know. But again, it probably doesn't matter because we're screwed now.
I mean, the thing is, obviously, with this administration, it's completely conceivable that, and likely, that Trump wants to really manage and control the messaging. In fact, there was reporting today, which is just horrible, but that Secretary of Defense Mark Esper sent a directive to commanders overseas because, you know, we have 75,000 troops stationed overseas in countries where there is this outbreak, including in South Korea. But Esper sent this directive saying, don't make any decisions related to coronavirus that might surprise the White House or run afoul of President Trump's messaging. I mean,
this is horrifying. We're not screwed, but we're potentially screwed.
The National Security Council has a position that's been open, like so many other hundreds of them. The global health security expert has been vacant for 2 years. We know the pandemic response team was dismissed. So there's different issues here. Number one is the issue of testing. Number two is the issue of treatment. Number three is the issue of vaccines, right? Prevention.
Well, vaccines, that's ongoing, but like that's...
Let's just talk a little bit about that.
I don't want to watch it again, Robbie. It's so painful.
Okay, not once, but let's just briefly explain to our listeners what's been going on with the vaccine issue, because there's been a number of like roundtables or pressers or something like in the last, wasn't it this last weekend, it's after we taped last, that Trump announced his coronavirus task force, right? I don't think that had happened when we taped last week.
When he appointed Pence, who then went on the radio show of Rush Limbaugh, was like, yes, Trump chose me for this because of my record of dealing with the AIDS crisis in Indiana.
Didn't he make that like much worse or something?
Yes. Okay. In fact, he caused many people to be infected with the AIDS virus that didn't have to be because of his actions. So, okay.
It's a small task force. It's Pence. It's Alex Azar, who is the Secretary of Homeland Security.
So I haven't read the article yet. Again, this is like, you know, busy day. This is like an hour ago, came out. I did see, however, and back to the whole testing thing and the whole snafu for how, like, we have no capacity for testing at this point. Turns out that Alex Azar is the current fall guy that they've chosen.
Oh, yeah. That they have. That's correct. He's the one they're pointing to, saying that he's the one who basically dropped the ball on moving quickly on responding to the outbreak here. I don't know. I haven't seen the details about why he's the fall guy yet and not,
because
for example,
he's in charge of, yeah.
Well, the director of the CDC, Robert Redford, is his name, apparently. Why isn't he the
fall because
guy?
He's a political lackey, and they support him. And also, technically, it is actually Alex Azar's like responsibility to
help
monitor
human services, right?
All the agencies and divisions, and to like have them work together as a team. So yeah, that should fall on him, but also the CDC. But
there
anyway, he's not
doctors.
Part of like Pence's like prayer crew.
Right. They were photographed praying together over the virus. There are three doctors on this task force. Again, very small task force. Alex Azar, Robert Redford, the CDC director, and Ken Cuccinelli, director of USCIS. Then a couple of doctors, including Anthony Fauci, I think is how you pronounce his name.
Fauci.
I should know by now. But anyway.
I was going with Fauci, but you said Fauci. I'm like, oh, God, I have it wrong now.
Is it Italian?
Let's call him Tony. Dr. Tony.
Dr. Tony. I like that. Yeah, Dr. Tony repeated like four
legit.
Times. Yes, he was legit. Four times in the last few days has basically corrected Trump on camera when Trump keeps saying, what, a few months? In a few months, 2 months, we'll have a vaccine? And over and over and over, this man is like, listen, in 2-3 months, we might be at the first phase of vaccine that has been tested and safe and ready to go is not going to be available for 1 to 1.5 years. And apparently he was supposed to present today about the virus at the Senate, at a luncheon, Senate Democrats luncheon, and he was abruptly told that you will not be able to present without an explanation.
Oh, really? He was Jesus. Yeah. I didn't even hear that. So yeah. Dr. Tony F. has been in the government for a long time. He is the real deal. He has served under like 6 million presidential administrations. And he first kind of came to this, like, on the public scene when it was reported that he was being, quote, muzzled. Because after Pence was appointed to head of this task force, he was suddenly kicked off his planned circuit and all the cable news weekend shows and told he couldn't give quotes without Pence's approval. Now, they, of course, tried to deny that. Like, oh, look, he's not really, like, that's all fake news. He was fine to, like, reapply for clearance to give interviews and then not be on any of the Sunday shows. Regardless, he did an interview with Politico, which I think is pretty crucial. And he had the following quote about what his job is like right now. He said, quote, "You should never destroy your own credibility. And you don't want to go to war with a president. Mm. But you got to walk the fine balance of making sure you continue to tell the truth." I mean, basically, he knows that, like, he has to be effective. And to do that, he can't go to war with a president, aka the President Trump.
What he might not realize, though, Susan, is by correcting him on camera.
You can't walk that.
That's a declaration of war to Trump. I really feel like he's going to get kicked off the task force just for that.
I do, too. He's the only one that is, like, white. Like, he is the only current voice of, like, sanity and objective skill and experience on the team that matters. And he is trying to walk this balance as if it can be walked. And that's horrifying. But the clip that, like, destroyed my soul, you know what, let's play it anyway, came from one of those millions of, like, PR briefings where Trump was, again, asking about vaccines. But this time he was like, okay, so we can't have a coronavirus vaccine overnight, but, like, what about the flu vaccine? Anybody?
We have nobody in this country vaccinated for coronavirus right now. So that if it goes through the...
But the same vaccine could not work. You take a solid flu vaccine, you don't think that would have an impact or much of an impact on corona?
No. Probably none.
He said a solid flu vaccine. Oh, my God. He said a solid flu vaccine, not knowing that every year there's a new, even the flipping flu changes, and you can't even use the old vaccines from the year before.
Yeah, those are flaky flu vaccines.
Yeah.
He's talking about a solid flu vaccine.
Yeah. Well, you know, considering, I wonder, when it comes down to Trump, I mean, we know he's a complete germaphobe. I don't know if he gets vaccinated or doesn't. I don't think he shakes hands with a lot of people, although now he's been doing his, you know, nightly, he's been basically following the Democratic primaries all over the country, holding rallies in every state where there's primaries, and then shaking hands with, of course, some of the people who come on stage and stuff. But somebody very close to him apparently was exposed to somebody with coronavirus, and that's Mike Pence. Did you read this report?
Like 3 degrees at this point. We don't know the full extent. But yes, again, very
that
possible.
That is enough to bag that man, put him in a plastic bag and fumigate him as far as Trump is concerned. But yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to say is, like, there's not a lot of controls around this. I mean, like, at the same press conference where Trump announces task force, there's video footage of, like, Mike Pence rubbing his nose and then shaking everybody's hands as they left the stage.
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
Speaking of which, everybody, stop shaking hands. No more shaking hands. Ever hugging, at least for, like, say, a month, maybe? Is that good? 2 months? I don't know.
So, like, here's the thing. This is going to be a tragic, like, even on the best case scenario.
It's going to be bad.
It will be a tragic personal disaster for a lot of people. Yeah. And the worst case scenario, it's going to be pretty horrific. But also, speaking for me personally, as someone who is privileged and, like, doesn't have, like, who could make it work, I feel like I'd be really fucking good at being quarantined.
You know why, Susan? Because we're podcasters, okay? I'm sitting in my PJs right now.
Like, I'm like, okay, so I have to talk to people. I just stay in my house and get, like, delivery for 2 weeks. I am down with that.
I can do it,
It's,
too.
Again,
I
a
know.
Huge tragedy. It's awful, but I'm like, I would not.
Even if the internet were to go, I can read. I have enough stuff, like, stocked in my pantry. And I have so much food stocked in, like, freezers and pantry. I could easily, like, stretch it out for at least a good 6 weeks.
I was doing the math earlier. I would live, like, for food. My cat would need some, like, outside supplies. But other than that, I would have a nice, like, quarantine vacation.
What if you release the cat and let her hunt? Just let her hunt and come back. Let him hunt. Let Ragnarok hunt.
Also, he can't kill a roach. He'll chase it and then can't kill it. So that's not going to work.
Okay. All right. So a little bit about other impacts of this virus. And that is that the Dow dropped 3,500 points last week. I mean, like, there's been some historic drops in the last few days. The global markets lost $6 trillion because of the outbreak. And, you know, Trump, you know, we know he's been heckling the Fed since he got into office. But apparently in response to the market getting all rattled up, the Federal Reserve did make an emergency interest rate cut. They slashed it by 0.5%, I think just today or yesterday, which is the biggest cut they've made since the 2008 financial crisis. However, that has not stopped from the markets from getting worse. It certainly is not going to stop the virus from spreading. But yeah, so there's just a huge economic fallout, and we, I guess, have yet to see how far that's going to go.
And Trump's only concern for this whole thing is how the markets are affected. That is his primary consideration.
Like, and he's a germaphobe too. His election thing, yeah.
Well, and that's about his election. Yeah. But it is, oh my God, this is, the thing is, so okay, even at this point, I am less optimistic than I was. I really was very optimistic about how we could handle coronavirus because, again, it's a very, not very, it's a manageable problem with a strong government response.
With some competence, with some basic competence. And
not basic, it's a complex issue. It's not a no-brainer, it's hard, but like it's doable for sure. So like I was less worried about the actual physical dying in the streets part of it. I'm still not thinking it's going to happen. But here's the part that can't be stopped. China recognized that this was a real threat. They knew that they could not mess around with this, and they made the call. Not because they love the rest of the world, want to help the rest of the world. They made the call for themselves that, okay, we got to shut down our entire economy almost
right.
for a two-week period to save ourselves. That's how serious this virus can be. But in doing that, they caused a massive disruption to the international supply chain that we have not fully felt yet. So mm-hmm. even aside from coronavirus in the U.S., even aside from our own local infections, we have this massive incoming ghost shipments for the next like month or so. Where we'd have so much trade coming in, that's just not there. It's gone. Not there. It's poof. It's off there. Yeah.
And I read a story about this one gentleman who, I mean, his work is that you know, he receives these shipments, he unloads them, they come from China and all over the place, and then he uses those same shipping containers to export American goods. And he can't do that now because they're not, like, he's not getting the containers. So American goods are also going to be sitting here for, I guess, for some shipping companies, if that's how they operate. And they're not going to have the means to ship them out.
Even if we handle the health side of it, the economic parts are not going to be stopped. Also, okay, so here's my other issue with all this. Coronavirus is causing an effect on the economy, but I do not think it's safe or good to assume that that is what the current volatility is about. We know that the Fed has been dealing with Trump's tantrums on Twitter for a while now, and they have not responded. They have typically been able to at least appear to be independent of that. And we know Jerome Powell met with Trump and was like, I'm not going to play political games, back off. But today, after Trump's tantrum last night, they dropped a half point to deal with coronavirus stuff. Maybe that's just because they finally gave in to Trump, but maybe it's because they know something. Maybe because it's a real problem. And here's the other issue. I don't think it's just coronavirus. So we had in, December 2018, we had the first, yield curve inversion.
Oh, that's right. I forgot all about that.
Yeah. And guess what? Historically, the average period of time between yield curve inversion and a recession is, give or take, 17 months. So, you know, between now and next 3 months or so, we're right on target for, the recession that yield curve inversion was signaling. Which is not always, it's not always signaling that, but historically, it has been, about 17 months out.
Well, so historically, every time there has been a recession, there's always been.
Not every time. There's been a false call.
Okay.
So it's not, perfect, but pretty damn good. And it's not immediate, 17-month, average, lead time. And we are right in that zone, which is where,
That's interesting. Well, it could be a little bit of both. I mean, there's no reason it's not.
Coronavirus is not helping, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Anyway, TLDR, for update and current status, we now have, the rules have been changed for the testing coronavirus. So it is now, it's basically, any doctor that wants it can get it. There's no longer a bottleneck in terms of who is allowed to get it and authorized to get it. There's still a bottleneck in terms of what we're able to do. We currently have about the capacity to do about 2,500 patients per week for testing, which, again, better than the, 100 a week we were doing, if that. But still very far short of what is needed to do anything.
Where's the testing happening? Who's doing the testing? That's what I want to know.
Well, now they've expanded it to not just be CDC. It can be state or private labs. So the future capacity has vastly expanded.
So people would have to like check with their like local state governments to see where testing's happening.
Yeah, well, the labs can do it once they get up to speed to do it. But the problem is, even though we have like Pence and others saying like, oh, by the end of the week, we'll have a million tests we can do. That is now theoretically true, but is assuming that every lab that could possibly do it is able to do it and is doing it around the clock. That right. is not true whatsoever.
And also the cost of scenario, thinking. I mean, like that everybody can afford the tests, right? Or who's going to foot the bill for these tests? So there's that too. And I, you know, there are plenty of people who are uninsured. Maybe, you know, won't be able to afford the tests. Then what?
Like our best case scenario is that if every lab gets caught up to speed and is doing its testing to maximum capacity, we could have like 30,000 tests per day. And that is impossible for the next, what, weeks, months? It's literally not even conceivable. So we are going to be far behind the ability to test for coronavirus, which means we can do no containment. And at this point, it is the only response that's possible because containment's off the table. It can't happen now. It's over. It's done. Coronavirus is here.
I'm kind of surprised that like schools are not shutting down for like I saw today that every
that wouldn't
university,
help either though.
Why? I think that would help a lot because
how it's long? Just, you'd have to do it for too long.
2 weeks, at least 2 weeks, I think. Right.
But it's not even spread far enough to make that. So in the places that were hotspots in China. That could be effective. But right now, if you shut down schools, it wouldn't do anything in like Oklahoma, where there's
right.
no.
Because then after 2 weeks, you reopen and it's back. Okay. Well, I mean,
and
I just read
do it again.
The entire United Arab Emirates, all of them, they closed down every university and school for a month.
They can do it. They're smaller. That's possibly like yeah. effective. Like there are awful authoritarian measures that can be done to sort of slow the spread. At this point, we're now looking at just trying to slow the spread because the real problem with coronavirus isn't necessarily the virus itself. It's the ability it has to overwhelm our existing infrastructure for healthcare. So anything can be done to slow it and to, you know, even out the load is all that we can hope for at this point.
I saw on Twitter that you want a puppy now. Is that right?
I absolutely want a puppy. I don't know if it's because I'm stressed or because the world's ending, but I really am like basically convinced that if I had a puppy that, I mean.
You'd feel better.
Everything would be perfect. Like, what would be wrong with the world?
Well, I bring that up because I saw that there was one poor little doggo.
No,
that was...
the Pomeranian was falsely accused. Excuse me, Robbie.
No, it was a weak,
it
weak
was
positive.
It was an environment positive. Environmental infection. The Pomeranian is basically like a doorknob.
Oh, okay, fine. So have you found
the
puppy yet?
Dogs are fine. I have not, and I should not and cannot. But if any of our listeners happen to find a heartbreakingly lost puppy that needs a home and wants to drop on my doorstep so I can tell my husband that, oh, look, it just showed up here and needs a home. Let's keep it forever.
Nobody will
just
tell
go
him.
Go ahead. Be my guest. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to some other news. A big story is that we have made peace with our enemies.
Barbie, what the hell's going on with this? Like, I had like, so I've been like very busy the past few days. I've,
I
like,
did
had
see
sporadic
your
awareness.
I did see your
holy shit.
IDEFK. I don't. What? I don't.
Oh, my notes. My notes in the draft were like, Robbie is like, here's a section on like making peace with a terrorist. And I was just like, IDEF. I don't even fucking know. That's where
I don't even
like,
fucking know.
What the hell?
All right.
So he's now has great relationships like the mullah. Like, what the.
All right. So this past Saturday, this is what you missed. This past Saturday, we entered.
Let's go back. Let's go back to, sorry, sideshow here. Let's go back to 2000 and, you know what, 2010. Or 2000, anytime like 10 years or earlier. Like, okay, guess what? In a decade or two, you're going to have President Trump bragging about his great relationships with the head of the Taliban.
Yep.
And John Bolton now being a leftist tool, who is the only voice criticizing this
totally
whole snafu.
I forgot about Bolton. I mean, these are the terrorists that we said we are not going to ever negotiate with. Don't you remember that line? I mean, post 9/11, it was like, we do not negotiate with terrorists. But
that
here
was
we are.
Trump's line on Twitter about Obama.
Right. But even that was a standard line. It was a standard line after 9/11 for Bush, for Obama, for anyhow. We have now negotiated a peace plan, which is not apparently exactly what we were told originally. So this past Saturday in Doha, Qatar, there were some senior American officials. They met with representatives of the Taliban, and they signed a peace agreement. The U.S. agreed that they're going to work towards lifting sanctions against the Taliban and even extended the possibility of Trump hosting Taliban representatives in the White House.
What?
Today, oh, yes.
Oh, my God. I didn't even know any of this.
Today, he had a call with the head mullah gentleman. And the only reason we know that is because the Taliban
the
tweeted about
gentleman.
It. Yes, but the White House didn't announce it. The Taliban tweeted about it, and that's how we know that that happened, that phone call took place. Now, here's what the United States has agreed in this agreement, that they're going to reduce U.S. troop levels to 8,600 personnel, close several bases, and what they announced at the time was that, what they publicly announced, that the Taliban would be required to cut all ties to Al-Qaeda and other terror organizations, and that they would enter power-sharing negotiations with the current government, because the Taliban, by the way, is not the government. They're an insurgent group that is, heavily armed and commits acts of terrorism against civilians and the government.
Afghanistan has a government. It exists. It's a thing. That
right.
They're discarding.
So, let's see. All right. Also, this agreement said that both sides in Afghanistan, meaning the Afghani government and the Taliban, would agree to a prisoner exchange. That this seems a little uneven to me, but the Afghani government would release 5,000 Taliban prisoners, and the Taliban release 1,000 prisoners. However, a spokesperson a couple of days later said that, we're not going to negotiate on power sharing with this government until the prisoners happen. So I think they're a little bit of a stalemate here. Now, Mitch McConnell said on the Senate floor on Monday, after nearly 20 years, two basic principles are clear. Number one, we should welcome any serious opportunity to bring greater stability to this land. But number two, we must make certain that the progress won through great sacrifice by Afghans and Americans is not undermined by any precipitous rush for the exits.
On the one hand, it's like, look, I'm not, this deal is kind of scary, but like having McConnell talk about a precipitous rush for the exits 20 years into a war.
Right. Well, guess what? It could be, it might be that everything that the administration is saying that they agreed to is actually, or it's getting in exchange for this, is actually not true. There was some reporting today that Representative Liz Cheney said in a House briefing today, because so the documents connected to whatever the plan was weren't released. They're like secret documents, but they agreed that we're going to furnish them to Congress. They furnished them to the House. In a House, after reviewing the documents, she said that that these documents do not include the terms. They do not include
always
the terms.
Always read the fine print with Trump.
Yeah, that they don't actually include the terms that Trump said they would include. It apparently does not require the Taliban to renounce Al-Qaeda. And it just seems like basically is the U.S. has agreed to withdraw troops just to get out. And I know that's something Trump has wanted without much.
Oh, it's the Kim Jong-un special.
Yeah, exactly. They say that's what they're saying, is that it's very similar to the North Korea. In Afghanistan, there have been parades. People are very happy. And a senior member of the Haqqani Network, which is a very dangerous terrorist network, says that even if we don't say the U.S. is defeated in Afghanistan, it's an open secret now that they are defeated. So, yay.
Like, I'll admit I am torn on this because, like,
on one hand, we want out. Yeah, I get it.
Oh,
I get it.
I mean,
yeah.
This is such an impossible situation that, like, instincts like Trump's are... I get why they're appealing. Like, is there ever going to be a good time to get out?
I
don't know if that's true. So, like, why not just, like, cut our losses and get out now?
Right, right.
And I'm sympathetic to that. But, like, also, that doesn't mean you have to do it like this. Like, there is a between, or at least I think there is between being there 20 more years and then just doing this. Surely we've had more of like a negotiating position than this.
I think what's dangerous about leaving like this is the fact that the current government, which by the way, Ashraf Ghani, who's the president of Afghanistan, the Taliban considers him like an American puppet that's been installed by the United States, which is kind of true. they wouldn't take part in elections. They told people in their areas to boycott the elections. But here's what they've also done. They have built, the Taliban has built up shadow, like a shadow government throughout the country that's operating as like they've taken over state schools and hospitals and other institutions, operating because they reject the legitimacy of this president and his government. And I think what's dangerous for the United States to move out like this, if indeed they are going to just basically draw down as much as possible. Yeah, is that they're leaving a government completely vulnerable. I mean, there's no way that this government can withstand, you know, the Taliban. They just can't. I mean, like, they're overwhelming in terms of their history. They've been there longer. I think they have, like, culturally, there's a lot of, you know, they have, like, deep roots there. There's a lot of suspicion in the United States, and people are not going to trust a government that had anything to do with the United States. And so I think it's just a matter of time before the Taliban completely is running the country all over again. For better or worse, but it's going to be worse. And I say that as somebody who totally opposed that war, but that was a horribly brutal regime for that nation, especially for the women of that nation. But I also want to talk a little bit about what Ivanka tweeted in response to the announcement. I wanted to just...
Oh, God. Just lay it on
me. Did you see it? Okay.
No, absolutely not.
So the White House tweeted out the announcement about this deal, and Ivanka retweets it and quotes Rumi. And for those who don't know, Rumi is like a centuries-old, amazing, like, mystic poet.
Of course she would. It's the kind of basic bitch she is.
It is really basic. What's sad about Rumi is he's incredibly profound. His writing is beautiful, and it's very deeply spiritual. But it's become like, when it's become translated for Western audiences, it has become like this kind of shit you see on, like, kitchen magnets and stuff now. What she quoted was actually really kind of interesting and weird, because she quoted a verse from a very famous poem of his that has to do with kind of like reconciliation, and it goes something to the effect of, come meet me out in the middle of the field where it's like, you know, it's neither your land nor my land, and like we kind of meet in the middle, and like that's a really conciliatory type of, you know. And I'm like, you're talking about the Taliban here. This is not, you know, that's not the kind of poem that you recite for the Taliban.
Wait.
Anyhow.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
This, I mean.
So.
What was like, in Trump, of course, in the past few days, is always like, the Taliban fighters are the best. They're amazing. They're tough cookies. Like, no one's better than the Taliban fighters.
Well, today, after this phone call, he's like, you know, I have a really great relationship with this mullah.
They're BFFs now.
Yeah. Oh, okay. This is exactly what she tweeted. And this is, again, a rough English translation of the original, which is in Persian. She tweeted, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and right doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. I want to throw up.
I'm sorry, Rumi. You didn't deserve this.
You didn't deserve this. And neither does the Taliban. Okay. So... So basically what that means, I feel like what it really comes down to is that we have just kind of like, you guys are on your own. You guys are on your own. And I get it to a certain extent, but here we are. It's not like we did this like 30 years ago. We're like, we're going to arm you to the, we're going to arm you to the hilt, and now you're on your own. And, you know, that is what resulted in the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And now here we are again. Okay. What's the phrase?
Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires?
Exactly. I will say this. My mother this weekend, God bless her, she's just like, what, they thought they were going to win Afghanistan? No, but my mom's ancestors come from Afghanistan, okay? We've got a little bit of that blood. So she's like, nobody can take over Afghanistan. She's like, we will die. I'm like, Mom, you're not from Afghanistan. She's like, whatever. She's like, we will die, but we will not give it to the imperialists. So there you go.
Can't wait to see what next wannabe...
empire.
Empire tries to take over Afghanistan.
China's probably like, no, thank you. We're good.
Yeah. but you know, I don't know. That has like a kind of like poetic fitness to it that I could see China be like, you know what? Okay. We've tried to expand our empire to, you know, Asia and other countries and given them loans and made them under our thrall, basically. I know no one wants to get involved over there. It never goes well. You don't want any land wars in Asia.
Yeah.
But like, let's give it a go.
I think China is smarter about how about their flex. Their flex is not like a military flex. Their flex is an economic flex.
Yeah, they're going to try and get involved in, like, loan money there. They can, like, take it over from, like, their loans.
They've done that with Pakistan. All then, of Pakistan is financed by China. Every port,
but it's
every
working
road.
There. See, proof of concept. They're like, okay, it totally works. Let's do it there too.
Yeah.
And then like, oh shit, this didn't work.
And you know what's actually crazy? I was thinking about when the coronavirus outbreak. I'm like, you know, Pakistan and China share a border. They're very, very close politically and diplomatically. There's a lot of Chinese people who live in Pakistan. There's a lot of trade. There's even intermarriage. There's all kinds of, like, you know, they're very close. And I was like, I really expect to see a big, like, spread in Pakistan, but it's been very, very few cases. I don't know if it's just because it's not getting caught. People might be dying of it, you know. Yeah, coronavirus. Yeah, very.
Oh
low.
No, it's all over there. It's all over there
in Pakistan. Let me hold on. Give me one second.
They have okay.
I have
again,
a live
reported
tracker.
Cases are at 5, but
right.
There is
that's what I meant.
Solid evidence of, like, a widespread infection.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. The reported cases, I mean, it's going to be a huge discrepancy between what's actually happening, what's being reported. Anyway, all right, yeah, so they can just buy everybody. If they can survive this, they'll just buy Afghanistan, and it's smarter to do. All right, coming back home, I want to talk about Trump in the courts. So we have a couple of different stories related to this. First one is a big legal win, I think, for Trump.
Temporary, though. Well, temporary, yeah. And then a temporary loss, and then a temporary, a more permanent win, probably.
It's but, eventually going to be, like, anyway, let's talk about this.
At this stage, temporary, yeah. McGahn, Don McGahn, former legal counsel to the White House, who was interviewed by Mueller. And was like, wow, Trump's doing some crazy ass shit. And I try to stop it. And then I just basically, like, ignored him to make him not do impeachable offenses. And I'm not even really paraphrasing there. I think he just called, like, Trump's doing crazy shit again. Let's stop it.
Okay.
So, yeah. Anyway, House wanted to talk to him for obvious reasons. Because he had prime evidence of Trump's obstruction. Like, he told Mueller about it. It was clear there was obstruction, and he was the point man that was there to do the obstruction that was like, oh, hell no, I'm not doing this, and didn't do it. So it didn't happen, because Trump's a giant, weak-ass, quote-unquote, chocker.
Mm-hmm.
Which is his spelling of choker.
Choker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the chocker. Oh, my God. Hey, like, why? Hey, no one's even told him yet. They're like, you don't spell choker that way, guy. Like, maybe you should, like, you know, get rid of the C.
People are too embarrassed.
Anyway, back in, like, what? Spring, like March, April, very early on after the Democrats retook the House, they tried to subpoena McGahn to testify about all this obstruction stuff he clearly knew about.
But the administration responded that McGahn and others have absolute immunity on this issue. And I guess that absolute immunity comes from, like, executive privilege.
No. He never cited that for a reason, because if he cited executive privilege, that has a whole, like, established host of legal precedence requirements. He just says immunity, like, full stop, without a reason.
Oh, just absolute immunity, full stop,
immunity.
Without anything. Oh, okay.
Executive privilege is not absolute by any means. It's a very narrow, like, tailored issue. So he's just like, nah, it's absolute for some reason. We're not going to explain.
And so what you're saying is absolute immunity is not actually a thing?
Not in this case, no.
Okay. However, the U.S. Court of Appeals for D.C. said...
Let's back up. The trial court decision came out. We talked about it in the show. Mm-hmm. The trial judge ruled that the president is not a king. They can't just block him from testifying if they want to. Sure, McGahn could go and testify, and at the hearing, he could invoke executive privilege if he wanted to and if it was appropriate. But he can't just say, I'm not testifying, absolute immunity, sorry. So we go to D.C. Circuit, and that's the decision we had come down this week.
And what happened?
We had a 2-1 decision between the two Republicans appointed and one Democrat. And they ruled that not that, you know, what Trump was doing was okay. In fact, they actually call it obstruction. But they ruled that in order to preserve the precious immunity of the Article 3 of the Constitution and to show how independent and non-political our federal courts are, they just couldn't get involved. You know, not appropriate, bad for us to do that, you know, not great PR. So in light of that, whenever the legislative branches try to sue the executive branches or vice versa, they're just going to not get involved and say, sorry, it's not just, we can't do it. Can't be done. Too bad. So sad.
I was shocked when I read this, because for them to say that federal courts shouldn't get involved in a dispute between the other two branches of government, then who does? Who makes a decision then when there is a dispute? I mean, this is what the opinion said. It said, sometimes these tools will yield fewer concessions than Congress might wish, but the remedy for that perceived wrong is in politics or the ballot box.
The tools that they're specifying, by the way, the tools that the Congress should apparently use, according to these judges, are tools like impeaching the president or using the appropriations power, the power of the purse, to block his spending. Now, keep in mind, a month ago, this president was acquitted after being impeached for abusing or for disregarding Congress's spending power to do what he wanted to help his election 2020. So again, we have a very recent and decisive test case that shows that the whole idea of these tools being effective that the courts are relying on, they don't work. I get it. So here's the temporary good news. This decision was in direct conflict with previous decisions from the DC Circuit. Like the whole DC Circuit sitting as a whole en banc. They have had, like, what, three cases that I think you're even cited by the majority in this case and disregarded, saying, like, no, we were allowed to hear this. That's okay. Like, yes, there are appropriate times for the courts to not step between the political branches and get involved in that whole fray, but we can do it. And the decision in this case from the two judges was like, okay, there's this precedent here, but we don't really like it, so we're not going to apply it. They can't do that. The DC Circuit, sitting as just like the panel there, they have no ability to override the entire circuit's previous decision. So this will go before the entire DC Circuit. It is almost certain they will overrule it. But then it goes to the Supreme Court, and God knows what will happen.
Right. But, you know, I do think it's interesting that in a way, I don't know to what extent that actually serves this administration, because it actually is more helpful for Trump to get a decision that says, yeah, the courts can solve these disputes, because at the end of the day, he can drag everything to the Supreme Court and he probably will get rulings in his favor. Whereas here, it's almost like what they're telling Congress is, man, use the powers you have. I read an article today that apparently in the House there is talk of issuing like either contempt.
Contempt of Congress.
Yeah, like against, like doing something about the House subpoenas that were not, that were not responded to.
So here's what the decision from the D.C. Circuit would mean. It's saying that the courts cannot get involved in political branch disputes. They should rely on their own powers and use their tools at their disposal. But what that really means is kicking it 19th century style, which for Congress means reinvoking its powers of contempt, which means the House has historically and inherently has the power to be like, yo, Bolton, we're arresting you and putting you in a cage till you start testifying.
They can. They can. And that's what CNN reported yesterday.
One, politically, right. Are they going to do it? No. But also, this is what the court is literally saying. Like, these judges are saying, you should use your own branch's powers to do this. And that branch's power is to get Sergeant-at-Arms to arrest people and put them in cages.
Yeah. What do you think about that, though? I kind of like that.
I mean, it's entertaining. Is it effective or politically appropriate or useful for our constitutional functioning? No. Entertaining, sure. We've only done it a few times. Well, here's the other point of this. Look, the courts are in a hard place. Because while the decision reached here, I think, is clearly wrong. And, well, it is clearly wrong. Like, the opinions that these judges had to follow say otherwise. And they're like, we don't want to do that. They can't do that. They don't have the power to do that. So this decision is wrong. But at the same time, it is a hard situation. Because we have made it 2.5 centuries now as a country with this issue kind of out there.
Mm-hmm.
And never before has been forced to get to this point. Like, it's never actually gotten here because it never needed to. There's never been an administration where it had to get to this point.
Right.
And the courts are like, y'all always worked it out in the past. Why can't you work it out now?
Yeah, it's, like, it's a different animal now. It's a different beast now.
So, yeah, the courts aren't wrong when they're like, hey, in the past, this has always worked itself out. Like, why do you really need us to get involved and ruin our pristine, non-political appearance? And that is scary in itself. Like, yeah, like, we are at a new stage because, again, in 2.5 centuries.
But maybe that's what it is then. This is not like any other administration. So maybe it's finally time for, why do those powers exist if at no point is it practical to use them or politically, you know, like
we
had
used
decision.
It. Like they did use the, I mean, the Sergeant of Arms stuff. They did use that back in the day.
Yeah.
But
so CNN reported yesterday that a number of representatives have said this, it's actually a discussion point right now. We are discussing holding individuals in contempt and maybe subpoenaing Bolton and then, you know, enforcing the subpoena. So I don't know where that's going to go.
No, they're going to hold in contempt, which means having like a trial and holding it. They're not going to do the whole put them in a cage thing.
Oh, man.
Which, and by cage, what I actually mean as a historical precedent is you put them in a nice hotel locally to Congress. So like the modern equivalent would be like having Sergeant of Arms track down Bolton, like grabbing him by the ear and putting him in the Ritz for a couple weeks.
I'll take it. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of attempts by the House to force information from the executive, tomorrow, my firm will be filing a brief for Supreme Court in the Mazars case, which is the case currently pending regarding the attempts by Congress to subpoena Trump's tax returns from various third parties, including Mazars, like his tax accounting firm, and a couple of the consolidated cases. Our brief is representing congressional scholars who are objecting to the fact that in the Mazars decision from the D.C. Circuit, which the Congress won, the House won in that case, there was a dissenting opinion by a recently appointed Trump judge, Judge Rao, in which she asserted that, in fact, the House's ability to obtain information from the president ceases the moment anyone suspects wrongdoing by the president.
What?
Yeah.
That's what the opinion said?
Her opinion is she goes through her version of historical precedent and says, actually, when Congress wants to get information, it can do so as the legislative branch. It can seek information that will help it make laws and, you know, draft new guidance for the country. And yet, the moment that there is a suspicion that what they're investigating or trying to address through legislation involves misconduct by an impeachable official, they cease to have that power until they formally institute an impeachment inquiry. Which, aside from everything else, is historically offensive because it is not grounded in any kind of historical reality whatsoever. And contrary to the dissent's claims, the House has not historically agreed in any form or fashion to the idea that their ability to investigate the president depends on them formally instituting an impeachment inquiry. So our brief will be addressing just that part of this case, which is fascinating and very important, especially now that it began. But I'll probably post it on Twitter. And our point is mostly that the Supreme Court should in no way rely on Rao's dissent because it has no historical grounding.
No basis in anything.
No basis whatsoever.
All right. So when will it be available to read online?
We're filing tomorrow. So it'll be up then Wednesday.
All right. Good luck. That's awesome. That's very exciting. You're up in the mix. Let's talk a little bit about, we talked last week about Trump's suing the New York Times. Today he filed a new lawsuit.
It keeps getting worse.
Yeah, today he filed a lawsuit. Did he once lawsuit? New law against the Washington Post. And the suit, once again, like the New York Times lawsuit, alleges defamation. It specifically talks about two specific stories that were related to, Russian interference, Mueller investigation, that kind of stuff, where there's some kind of language that Trump invited Russian interference, something to that extent. So, if they're able to win on these in these lawsuits, like, what do you think that's going
to
look like?
They're not trying to win. They can't win. They're not trying to win.
They're just trying to scare people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but keep in mind that the actual language, not quoting, but from close memory here, in the Washington Post suit they filed today, it says that there was defamation by the Washington Post for having articles that talked about Trump's efforts to, or Trump's conspiring with Russia to interfere in the election. Mm-hmm. Because Mueller did not, he found that although there were attempts to conspire, he did not find evidence that would support a criminal charge for conspiracy with Russia. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's their actual story. Like, the actual language is like, this is false, because although Butler found that there was an attempt to conspire, they never succeeded.
So what?
Which is not even true. Not true, because Mueller just found that, like, there's an attempt, but nothing that supports criminal charge, which is a very different standard.
Mm-hmm. I mean, an attempt is you actually doing it. I mean, he did it, right? It was more than an attempt. He did conspire, but it just didn't rise to...
Yeah. Mulder whatever. Found that they were open, that the Trump administration or Trump campaign was open to it, and they were both simultaneously working towards a shared end, but that the evidence fell short that would of something that would support a conspiracy charge. Which, again, is a very different standard from what is, like, true and not true and what should be reported on.
I know you think this maybe is not going to be, like, litigated all the way through, but...
It will be. They'll carry it to the end, and they'll lose. Okay. But they'll carry it to the end and make it very expensive, and they'll be like, oh, look at our suits proving this is all a lie.
But do you really think... like, Trump, to me, doesn't seem like the kind of guy who was going to throw money away. I feel like he doesn't like to spend money.
He didn't sue personally. It's Trump campaign.
That's what I was going to ask, is where's the money coming from? Money. In the civil suit? It's a civil suit that was filed today.
Yep, and it's Trump campaign. It's none of his money on there. Just like Devin Nunes, almost certainly. I mean, we know Devin Nunes could not afford to do all the lawsuits he's filing against, like, Twitter cows. There's an outside source funding it, and he needs to disclose it. Mm. In this case, we know the outside source, and that's just, like, the whole Trump campaign funding. But, yeah, it's not coming from their own pockets.
All right. Anything else? Should we check in on the polls? See what's going on? I really don't want to. Nope. I'll take a quick look on Twitter before we wrap up.
Leave that to tomorrow.
Well, it looks like it's Biden and Bernie is what it's looking like tonight. Although, you know, these are 40% of the delegates decided on Super Tuesday, but that's not all of them. So there's still more. There's still more primaries. And we will be at the butt end of that. Susan, you and I.
Yay, June.
All right. I am exhausted. I know you're exhausted and you still have a long night ahead of you. Go Supreme Court brief. Yay. I'm excited to read it. And we'll talk about it next week.
Will do.
All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in a week. A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.
So he had no fur, and they thought at first that it was because he, like, had mange or something, because he had bad, he's fine. They're like, he's fine. He'll grow fur again. But then he never did. And it turns out he's an Inca orchid, like a Peruvian dog that never has hair. So they're like, waiting for his poor set to grow hair back. And he never did.